This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
She's the talented one.
She's the hard worker.
She's the pretty one.
She's the competitive
one. She's the stable one.
She's the one that Dad likes more.
Sisters. An all-new season of The Heart. The show that tells big, complicated, and beautiful stories about love. Tells the big, complicated, and beautiful story that is sisterhood. The Heart, wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello and welcome to a new year in books. We're going to bring you a wealth of fascinating new fiction in 2023 and perhaps help you rediscover some titles already lurking on your bookshelf. As for today, we're bringing old and new together as we discuss the modernist writer Catherine Mansfield, who died 100 years ago this month, aged just 34. D.H. Lawrence, a friend and sometime admirer of her work, judged that she belonged to her day and will fade. But Virginia Woolf described her fiction as the only writing I've ever been jealous of. Who was Catherine Mansfield? What is her legacy? And how did she change the course of the short story? To explore her life and work, I'm joined by Claire Harmon, author of the new biography All Sorts of Lives, the short story writer and novelist Lucy Caldwell, and the academic Chris Morant, whose discovery of a long-lost Mansfield story tells its own tale about her messy publishing history. Welcome, all of you, to Open Book. Claire, I love the prominence your book gives to Mansfield's writing. It's a biography told through her stories. Can you describe the structure and tell us how you came to write the book this way?
Well, it evolved from various things, wanting partly to write a book about Mansfield's life, but it actually, the centenary was coming up, and I wanted to find out more about her life, but I also wanted to look at her as a short story writer because of this, you know, the centenary to me, very much evokes her neglect as an influence. She hasn't really been taken into the canon in the same way. And I think it's partly because of the form that she excelled in, the short story, you know, not a novel, not a kind of epic poet. And I was reading her in lockdown, didn't have access to libraries. It was just me and her works, and to choose 10 stories, which they're not in a strict chronological order, and they don't seek to make distinct parallels between the life and the art. But I think her art and her life are in such an interesting balance, and it's such a symbiotic world that I wanted just to find a form that would enable that and be quite conversational too. I wanted the book to be an easily approached way of finding out about Mansfield if you didn't know anything about her.
Well, Lucy, we're talking about the form of the short story there, and you are a short story writer yourself. What is it that chimes with you most about Mansfield's work?
Mansfield's work, I think one of the things I love about Claire's biography of her is, Claire, you describe it as the work of an enraptured reader. And I love coming to Mansfield through her stories, through her work. There's something that, that Claire says. She's describing Mansfield writing one particular story, and Claire says she put this scene into her story pretty much intact, or perhaps it's more accurate to say that she put her story into this scene. And I think, to me, that's such an astute way of describing what Mansfield does, with this sense of trying to capture the life within a life. For me, Mansfield is, she's almost like one of those, well, she is one of those great female mystics. She sees writing as a religion, as a spiritual quest. And she wants to move away from plot. I think that's one of the great things she does with a short story, or intensifying what Catherine Mansfield called the so-called small things, the overtones, the halftones, the quarter tones, the hesitations. She's a very musical writer, and her work is full of passion.
Yeah, that's striving, such a key part of her project. Chris, can you tell us a little bit about your research and how that came about?
The kind of surprising thing that came out of that research was the way in which Mansfield didn't restrict herself to the short story by any means. But if we look at what she was publishing in a very short period of time, you know, she's only a professional writer for 15 years, publishes her two major collections towards the end of her life. But in the years before those two collections come out, she's publishing hundreds and hundreds of, you know, travelogues, aphorisms, dialogues for one voice, poems, translations, parodies, satires, literary reviews. So she's an incredibly prolific writer and deserves to be thought of in those ways as well as just a short story writer.
Yeah, it's a dizzying kind of volume of work she was producing, as you say, in that limited space of time. Let's go back to her origins, though, briefly. Claire Mansfield was a New Zealander. She was brought up in a middle-class family in Wellington. When did her passion for writing start to find expression?
When she was a teenager, really. But she was simultaneously very obsessed and engaged by the world of professional musicians. And she was at that stage thinking of being a cellist and a professional musician, with the writing, which clearly she excelled at even as a young person and a child. But when she came to school in London, she developed a great, you know, love of writing and getting published and being read by her peers. She always wanted to have an audience. And then when she went back to New Zealand, intending not to live there for very long, but to emigrate, she was really thinking of herself as a writer, and a writer, quite surprisingly, in the mould of Oscar Wilde. I mean, she was very much enthralled by the fantasy eclé writers. I mean, she then kick-started a sort of modernism of her own, quite on her own too. I mean, she was writing a sort of stream of consciousness style before that was acknowledged as a thing.
As you say, she moved back to London, never went back to New Zealand again. And her first collection in a German pension was published in 1911. But in between 1908 and 1911, she experienced several adventures, both in her writing and her life. What was going on in her life then?
What wasn't going on? I mean, she was 19, she was just about to be 20. And in those couple of years, she kind of went through a terrible sort of mangle emotionally. She fell in love. I mean, she was very susceptible to all sorts of, you know, passionate feelings. And it was very hard to be a young woman and not get pregnant if you're having sex with your lover at the time. And she had, you know, pregnancies, miscarriages. She married the wrong man for one day and was sent off to Bavaria by her mother to live out the pregnancy in some decent secrecy. And that's where she lost the child but gained a lot of insight into writerly life through a Polish writer she met there, and came back to London in 1909 with a very honed sense of what European literature was doing, various art movements. She was kind of reanimated and then threw herself into London life and the life of the little magazines and the avant-garde, and was the startling and exciting figure that John Middleton Murray met and fell in love with in 1911. So, you know, then their partnership sort of cemented certain things in her life.
So it wasn't until 1917 that she published again. Chris, she was, however, writing a lot throughout those years, as Claire said. Why was there the delay in publication, and what was it that she was exploring in this period?
Well, I think in this period, magazine publication was enough for Mansfield. It was a way of getting paid on a very practical level for her work and becoming a paid writer. Magazine publication in this kind of decade before she publishes her major collections, Bliss and The Garden Party in 1920 and 1922, allows her to try on different literary masks, really, to become a kind of chameleon, writing for different publication contexts, different readerships, and working out who she wants to be as a writer. And it's this kind of playing with different authorial identities which makes Mansfield so difficult to pin down, actually. But the thing that strikes readers, I think, about Mansfield on first encountering her work is just the sheer variety, the different perspectives that we're given in these stories, the different ways in which they're written, the different voices that we hear in them. She's negotiating different editorial expectations and writing for certain audiences. And as I say, that allows her to hone her craft in this decade before publishing her most famous collections.
Now let's hear a short opening passage from that story that she was a harsh judge of, but I think anyone would have to say is a masterpiece. It's The Garden Party, which was published in 1922.
And after all, the weather was ideal. They could not have had a more perfect day for a garden party if they had ordered it. Windless, warm, the sky without a cloud. Only the blue was veiled with a haze of light gold, as it is sometimes in early summer. The gardener had been up since dawn, mowing the lawns and sweeping them, until the grass and the dark flat rosettes where the daisy plants had been seemed to shine As for the roses, you could not help feeling they understood that roses are the only flowers that impress people at garden parties. The only flowers that everybody is certain of knowing. Hundreds, yes, literally hundreds, had come out in a single night. The green bushes bowed down as though they had been visited by archangels.
As you might have picked up on there, one of Mansfield's defining contributions to the short story are her first lines. They often start in the middle of a thought, and after all, the weather was ideal. Lucy, could you tell us more about the importance of this device? And I know you've described it before using Mary Lavin's phrase, an arrow in flight. What is she doing with these kind of in media res beginnings?
I often think of what David Mamet says of playwriting, where he says once he's finished a play, he lops off the first scene because it's just limbering up, and he cuts off the last because it's just indulgence and you just want to be straight into the action. And there's a similar technique there where she is. She's arresting us. We get the sense that that moment has been very carefully chosen from the beginning of the story. We're rushing to keep up. You know, we're suddenly filling in the worry of the characters and their discussions. And actually, it looks like there might be rain that day or whatever. So we're coming into a story that's already moving. And so I think, you know, the Mary Lavin phrase is perfect. The arrow in flight.
Yeah, Chekhov said something similar about cutting off the beginning and end. He said that's where we writers lie most of all. Claire, in your book, you discuss the wider influences Catherine drew from, and she was writing in the first great age of cinema, and she even worked as an extra on a couple of productions. How much was cinema an inspiration, and how much of it can we see in the work?
I think you can see quite a lot of it. I mean, you know, retrospectively, and she was doing things well, as with this speedy start of many of the stories. She's kind of showing rather than telling. I mean, that's what she likes to do, is to kind of get to the effect rather than ponderously telling you what the effect is about to be and then doing it. I think she does kind of tracking shots quite often and she does, cuts. I mean, she cuts in time. She kind of moves between characters very abruptly. She, you know, goes between one consciousness and another. So she kind of inhabits these different points of view very much so. And, you know, she does, especially in, I think, an Indiscreet Journey, it's almost actually like a film starting up when she's on the train and she describes the train speeding up, and it's really like pictures in a zoetrope or in a cinematograph. She kind of sees the film of the story in her mind, and I think they do reproduce themselves in a reader's mind in a kind of filmic way.
Deliberately or not, as you say, yeah. It's interesting the kind of the consciousness of it and what level of that there is. Chris, you've picked out a few lines from the end of her story, The Wind Blows. Would you read that ending for us and then tell us a little about what you think it reveals about her work?
Sure. Look, Bogey, look over there. A big black steamer with a long loop of smoke streaming, with the portholes lighted, with lights everywhere, is putting out to sea. The wind does not stop her. She cuts through the waves, making for the open gate between the pointed rocks that leads to... It's the light that makes her look so awfully beautiful and mysterious. They are on board, leaning over the rail, arm in arm. Who are they? Brother and sister. Look, Bogey, there's the town. Doesn't it look small? There's the post office clock chiming for the last time. There's the esplanade where we walked that windy day. Do you remember? I cried at my music lesson that day. How many years ago? Goodbye, little island. Goodbye. Now the dark stretches a wing over the tumbling water. They can't see those two anymore. Goodbye, goodbye. Don't forget. But the ship is gone now. The wind. So we spoke before about the garden party and the effect of in media res openings. That's a story which ends with the main character, Laura, struggling to describe what life is. She said, isn't life. And it ends with this unsaid thought that we as readers are meant to intuitively grasp. Something similar is going on here in the way in which this ending kind of pulls the rug from underneath our feet as readers. We're not quite sure where we are or what we're meant to make of this. As there's this sudden shift with an ellipsis, and we go from focusing on a young girl, Matilda, on the seashore looking at a ship, to then being with Matilda as an older woman on the ship looking back at the shore. And it's a shift which happens in a breath incredibly quickly. which, as I say, wrongfoots us as readers and forces us to question everything that we've just read. You know, is this story remembered from the position of adulthood looking backwards, or is this vision at the end a kind of dreamlike premonition of the future? Mansfield never tells us, and it's that lack of explanation, that refusal to round off her plots with a neat resolution, that defines her modernism, really. And it's something which she takes from Chekhov. We've already mentioned Chekhov. Mansfield spends a couple of years translating Chekhov's letters for publication in the Athenaeum, and she writes to Wolfe about one particular letter where Chekhov talks about the question that must be put. And it's not the job of the writer to provide answers, it's the job of the writer to just pose questions and leave things open-ended and for the sound to go on and on. And that's an incredibly powerful idea for both Mansfield and Wolfe at this time, and we see it at play in this story.
We've talked about Chekhov, as you say, Chris, more than once, and there is a sort of elephant in the room when discussing Catherine Mansfield, and it too is Chekhov, because he was obviously an influence, but in the particular case of her story, The Child Who Was Tired, it's very, very similar to Chekhov's story, Sleepy. What was the controversy that arose from that?
It's a kind of version of Chekhov's story. It's got exactly the same setup and plot, with very, very distinct differences as well. But later on, I mean, after she was dead, it was then she was then accused of plagiarising Chekhov, as if she'd been trying to pass this off. There is a cloud hanging over it. But I think when you look at her writings about Chekhov later, and also when there's a letter that she writes to a young writer in about 1920-21, where she says, oh, you know, this is so like Chekhov, your story, it's almost like a translation. And, you know, the clarity with which she approaches that, it doesn't seem to me like somebody who's had a guilty feeling about having ripped Chekhov off herself.
I can see Lucy and Chris are both eager to come in. I feel like I'm on a call-in show. Lucy.
Yeah, there's a lovely line in her journals that I thought we should hear, and she says, Chekhov, why are you dead? Why can't I talk to you in a big darkish room at late evening where the light is green from the waving trees outside? I'd like to write a series of heavens, that would be one. And, it, you know, again and again in her journal, she does talk to Chekhov. She writes to him and she talks to him. Often she dreams of him. You know, they meet in dreams and talk. And I think she does see him as someone who is a kindred, who is on the same path, they're on the same quest.
Chris.
I entirely agree with Claire in your assessment that this isn't plagiarism. It's a kind of free transposition of Chekhov's story, which Mansfield sees as an entirely legitimate thing to do in terms of experimenting with the form. And it's something she does elsewhere. Her story, The Common Round, which is an early form of the later story Pictures, is clearly indebted to a story by Colette about a similarly impoverished ballerina, in this case, who's haunted by the same kind of procession of food, the Eidomostes. Another story, Tales of the Courtyard, clear echoes of Dostoevsky. So these borrowings, it's not plagiarism. It's a way for Mansfield to revolutionise the English short story by borrowing from international literatures and other kinds of writing.
Okay, it seems the jury is voting not guilty on this one. So Mansfield was a professional reviewer, and I wanted to talk about that aspect of her work. She was also a great private commentator on other writers' work. I love her description of E.M. Forster's Howard's End. Not good enough. He never gets any further than warming the teapot, but there ain't going to be no tea. Chris, was reviewing a distraction from her work, or was it an important part of it?
Yes and no, to sit on the fence. It is a distraction, a clear distraction from her work for 2 years. Because it's so demanding. She's writing every week for the Athenaeum, reviewing sometimes 3 books a week, which again shows just what a voracious reader she was. But at the same time, she's using those reviews to articulate ideas about what writing should be doing in this post-war moment, 1919, 1920. And she's basically saying contemporary writing isn't good enough. So I gave the example of her review of Wolfe's Night and Day, where she's saying, look, these new thoughts, these new feelings coming out of the war, they need a new form. They need new forms of expression. Writers needed to do better, so that when she came out with Bliss and then The Garden Party, it seemed like the realisation of those hopes for what modern literature could look like and do.
I'd like to home in on Mansfield as a modernist specifically. I mean, she was publishing alongside Joyce and Eliot and Pound, but she's never really placed alongside any of them. Is that maybe because the form in which she worked, the short story, was and often still is seen as being, you know, a lesser form?
Possibly. I think, you know, the way that we're talking about her work and how she writes, it's so evidently modernist. You know, I think Claire said she's modernist on her own. She launches her own modernist movement. I think one thing we haven't mentioned so far is how funny she is as well. You know, she's very, very witty. She's very sharp. Her descriptions and the way she talks in her letters about it's possible to catch someone. It's hard, but it's possible. A child is a tiny wishbone of a child. Or she talks about a maid slamming down a white terrified blancmange. You know, she's very, very funny as well. When she wants to be.
Chris, your face lit up when Lucy mentioned humour there.
Yes, because she never wants to be called out as taking herself too seriously. And I think it's that which distinguishes her from other modernists like Joyce and Eliot, who require almost footnotes as you're reading to understand them. And she never got on with that kind of modernist writing. Her writing is effortless in its prose, you know, and never demands too much of the reader. But if your attention wavers for a breath, you lose the thread, and it does require your attention all the time. So I think it's that characteristic to her work which has perhaps put her outside the fold of high modernism as it was constituted in the mid-20th century around the so-called men of 1914, Joyce, Eliot, Wyndham Lewis, Pound, who she always thought of as being peculiarly arrogant in their maleness. She's always distinguishing herself from that set of writers.
Oh, Claire, you wanted to come in there.
She is hilariously funny about some of those writers. I mean, she's a terribly harsh critic, but then when the humour kicks in, and she met Joyce in Paris in 1922, and there's a very funny description in one of her letters to Violet Schiff, when she says that she Mansfield had read the Odyssey, and she said, "I'm more or less familiar with it. But Murray and Joyce simply sailed away out of my depth. I felt almost stupefied. It's absolutely impossible that other people should understand Ulysses as Joyce understands it."
Lucy, you wanted to talk about a passage from Mansfield's story, Bliss. Could you set it up for us, and afterwards we'll talk about why you've picked it?
Yes, of course. This is one of the pivotal moments towards which the story builds. It starts off with a young married mother. She comes back in from outside as the story opens to start setting up for a dinner party. At those last words, something strange and almost terrifying darted into Bertha's mind. And this something, blind and smiling, whispered to her, "Soon these people will go. The house will be quiet, quiet. The lights will be out. And you and he will be alone together in the dark room, the warm bed." She jumped from her chair and ran over to the piano. "What a pity someone does not play," she cried. "What a pity someone does not play." For the first time in her life, Bertha Young desired her husband. Oh, she'd loved him. She'd been in love with him, of course, in every other way, just not that way. And equally, of course, she'd understood that he was different. They'd discussed it so often. It had worried her dreadfully at first to find that she was so cold, but after a time it had not seemed to matter. They were so frank with each other, such good pals. That was the best of being modern. But now, ardently, ardently, the word ached in her ardent body. Was this what that feeling of bliss had been leading up to?
I love that. What made you choose that, Lucy?
Well, I chose it because I think that sentence, you know, ardently, ardently, the word ached in her ardent body. If I could choose one word to describe Catherine Mansfield, it would be ardent. And it would be that story is suffused, is filled with things being more than, you know, Bertha Young feels she's on a glimpse of understanding, understanding the world, the universe. There's a pear tree in full frothy bridal blossom, and she feels she's on the verge of understanding that. She feels that the woman that she's brought along to the party understands it with her. You know, there are all these cross currents and undercurrents of desire. The way that she so deftly writes that desire, the way that it shocks the character that she might desire her husband for the first time and everything that might happen, Mansfield draws so deftly so much together. what goes on to happen in the story is she realizes at the very end that her husband is having a tryst or arranging a tryst with the woman that she's brought along. And so the story utterly deflates. And it's not clear whether everything that she's been feeling in the story is because of her desire, or if her desire has become the container for everything that she's feeling. But everything seems to draw together in that moment, just before everything is taken away from her.
Well, just finally, I wanted to ask each of you what 100 years after her death you think Mansfield offers readers today. Why should we be seeking out her stories? Chris, would you like to go first?
Well, yeah, I ask myself this question every time I teach Mansfield, because invariably 3 or 4 students will come into the room visibly brimming with energy and enthusiasm because they've discovered this writer for themselves. And I think it's that which is so exciting to writers, to readers. And also the kind of shock of recognition that even though these were composed over 100 years ago, yes, life is like that. Yes, relationships are like that. They're messy, they're full of tension. But also the joy within these stories is something that I'd emphasize, just the sheer joy in life that's made more intense by Mansfield's awareness that it was ending for her, that it would soon be over. That's something that I take away from these stories and that I encourage other readers to look for themselves.
Lucy.
I love that description of the students brimming over as they've discovered Mansfield for themselves. And I think that's exactly it. You know, she says that writing for her means to enrich, to give. For me, still, she's a writer. She is still underappreciated. She's still there to be discovered, to be learned from. And her stories, her sense of writing as spiritual quest as well, I think is something very profound, something you feel maybe as you read her journals especially.
Claire, I think your biography offers a wealth of reasons why we should read Mansfield. If you had to pick one, what would it be?
Well, her vitality with the melancholy of her sensibility too. So when she's brimming with life, she's and this kind of joyful impulse, but it's the shadow of death, and is around everything. It's an amazing combination, but that ability of hers to notice things, the word noticings is something that Philip Larkin characterized her writing, that she could actually she was alert to all the joyful things and just the vital things, just the sheer liveliness of life. It does make her an incredibly present person. So, you know, you pick up these books and she's just so freshly on the page there. It's really quite unlike any other 20th century writer, I think. She does feel like a friend who's been waiting to introduce themselves.
Well, I felt she was almost in the room with us, thanks to all you three. My thanks to Claire Harmon, Lucy Caldwell and Chris Morant. All Sorts of Lives is out now, published by Chatto and Windus, alongside a new collection of Mansfield short stories, Wild Places. Chris Morant's Catherine Mansfield and Periodical Culture is published by Edinburgh University Press, and you can find details of all the titles mentioned today on our book list on the website. Next week, I'll be back with more Riches, talking to Jane Smiley about her Gold Rush murder mystery, A Dangerous Business, and exploring queer history with Tom Crewe and Nell Stevens. But for now, from me, goodbye.
She's the talented one.
She's the hard worker.
She's the pretty one.
She's the competitive
one. She's the stable one.
She's the one that Dad likes more.
Sisters. An all-new season of The Heart, the show that tells big, complicated, and beautiful stories about love. Tells the big, complicated, and beautiful story that is sisterhood. The Heart, wherever you get your podcasts.